This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we present a special segment on New York City proclaiming that Ethel Rosenberg was innocent.
62 years ago, the sentencing judge, Irving Kaufman, said that Ethel Rosenberg was responsible for the death of some 50,000 American soldiers in Korea. And now, last Monday, she was honored on the steps of City Hall by the New York City Council. Give a listen.
We interview filmmaker David Felix Sutcliffe on his new film, with an unusual twist, Terror.
The twist is that David and his co-filmmaker followed around the FBI agent without the FBI knowing it.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
The Rosenberg atomic spy case of 1951 was one of the most famous political trials in American history. Both Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were from New York and had been active in the American Communist Party. When they were arrested in 1950, it was at the height of the hysteria of the infamous red-hunting McCarthy decade. In 1950, the Russians first tested their atomic bomb, and the United States initiated the Korean War. The effects of the Cold War and the execution of the Rosenbergs was so devastating to the left that we are still just now overcoming it. Ethel and Julius were electrocuted to death at Sing Sing Prison 2 years later. At the sentencing, Federal Judge Irving Kaufman said that the Rosenbergs were guilty of facilitating the death of some 50,000 American soldiers in the Korean War. And President Eisenhower, who declined to grant clemency, said that what the Rosenbergs did might likely be responsible for the deaths of tens of millions in the event of an atomic war. The government tried to get Julius Rosenberg to confess and give names. A representative from the Attorney General's office visited him in Sing Sing Prison. Rosenberg said no. He said, "We are the victims of a most monstrous frame-up." Subsequent scholarship has shown that Ethel Rosenberg was totally innocent and that Julius Rosenberg was not an atomic spy and that there was no secret to the atomic bomb. It was a question of industrial technique. Now, 62 years later, Ethel Rosenberg was honored by the New York City Council on the steps of City Hall on September 28th. They read a proclamation that said Ethel Rosenberg was innocent and lauded her for her achievements and her bravery. It would have been her 100th birthday. Here are some excerpts from the event and some voices of those who knew Ethel.
Before we go to that audio, Michael, I wanted to note that so many of the tactics that the FBI and the government used against the Rosenbergs are in use today, namely fear-mongering in the name of national security, and actually using Ethel in this case as leverage and trying to get Julius to turn and cooperate with the government.
Very cynical, because the subsequent documentation has shown that they knew that Ethel was totally innocent, and nevertheless they were willing to execute the mother of a 10-year-old and a 6-year-old in an attempt to get Julius to confess to a crime that he didn't commit.
It also sends the strongest possible message to an entire nation, Michael. Literally an execution. So, as we've seen with other highly political cases, Lynn Stewart, Jeremy Hammond, so many others, the government makes an example of a person that many of us can relate to on a very human level and says, look, this is what might happen to you. In this case, they took two lives to do that.
40 years ago, Robert and Michael Mirapol wrote a book about the legacy of their parents, Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. The book is called We Are Your Sons. And Heidi is going to read the last letter that Ethel wrote and that both of them signed to their children just before they were killed. The letter is prefaced in the book by Robbie, who writes, "In Sing Sing, my parents were permitted to spend the afternoon together, separated by the usual wire mesh. The accelerated schedule for execution forced the prison to dispense with the traditional last meal. My father merely asked for an extra pack of cigarettes. They wrote Robbie and me one final letter.
Dearest sweethearts, my most precious children, only this morning it looked like we might be together again after all. Now that this cannot be, I want so much for you to know all that I have come to know. Unfortunately, I may write only a few simple words. The rest your own lives must teach you, even as mine taught me. At first, of course, you will grieve bitterly for us, but you will not grieve alone. That is our consolation, and it must eventually be yours. Eventually, too, you must come to believe that life is worth the living. Be comforted that even now, with the end of hours slowly approaching, that we know this with a conviction that defeats the executioner. Your lives must teach you, too, that good cannot really flourish in the midst of evil, that freedom and all the things that go to make up a truly satisfying and worthwhile life must sometimes be purchased very dearly. Be comforted then that we were serene and understood with the deepest kind of understanding that civilization had not as yet progressed to the point where life did not have to be lost for the sake of life, and that we were comforted in the sure knowledge that others would carry on after us. We wish we might have had the tremendous joy and gratification of living our lives out with you. Your daddy, who is with me in the last momentous hours, sends his heart and all the love that is in it for his dearest boys. Always remember that we were innocent and could not wrong our conscience. We press you close and kiss you with all our strength. Lovingly, Daddy Julie and Mommy Ethel.
Robbie Meeropol, congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Tell us how you feel today.
Well, this is the culmination of years of effort. I felt, at least from in the last 20 or 30 years, that when discussing my parents' case, there was often kind of a... Well, there was Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, and Ethel was kind of disappeared into Julius. Not that I make that as a criticism of my father, but her case was never looked at specifically. And so when her 100th birthday approached, this presented an opportunity to really focus on her. And you know, her case is the most egregious. The idea that the prosecutors would grab someone and use them, not because there was evidence, but as a lever to coerce someone else to say what they wanted him to say, coerce my father into saying what they wanted him to say. That idea is a threat to us all. That kind of tactic can be used against anyone. And to bring that out and to have that publicly recognized in this way, as I said before, it's a dream come true.
Robbie, do you think that the public is more sophisticated now in terms of understanding FBI coercion and other factors that were at play?
I think that it's a complicated question. Yes, in many ways the public is more sophisticated. There is an understanding of manipulation of evidence. But there is such a climate of fear that has been generated in post 9/11 that even though people know that, a lot of people are willing to accept it. And that in some ways is a more dangerous situation, because if we know it and accept it, then it becomes inevitable that it will grow. And so we've got to do everything we can to remove that acceptance. And one of the ways to do that is to show that innocent people got executed.
Robbie, if I might, and stop me if I'm overreaching, but might you please share with us, I know you're only 6 years old when she was executed, but might you please share with us your early memories of your mother?
Well, what I remember of my mother, you know, and it's funny, like being a 3-year-old, when she was arrested. I have virtually no memories of my parents before their arrest, so I remember them in prison. And what I remember about my mother was that she was short. Ethel Rosenberg was 5 feet tall. But she was a powerful personality. And that, what I remember, is quiet and calm and a sense of warmth and love. But I will admit to you that I don't know if those are the wishful thinking memories of an adult looking back on his early childhood, or if that really is the way it was. But that said, I don't think my brother and I would have been able to bounce back as well as we did if we didn't have a good few years to begin with. So those who want to demonize Ethel and Julius Rosenberg and say they neglected their children in order to pursue their politics, I can say the evidence, at least as far as I'm concerned, is that we had a warm and loving and functional family, and that's one of the reasons why the two of us have survived as well as we have.
Politically, both your parents were socialists. They believed that the problems of this country and the world ultimately derived from the capitalist way of organizing an economy. And what do you think that their message is for today?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I hope that they would, if their politics would have evolved along with mine, to understand the overarching issue that, you know, not only is capitalism a destructive system in terms of the way human beings are exploited, but we are in the process of destroying the productive capacity of the planet, which is an overarching issue. And if we continue as we have, it's going to be very difficult for more than a very small percentage of people who are on the planet today to survive. And I hope that they would have evolved in that direction. But of course, that's one of the things about capital punishment and the removal of people, is that we really don't know.
On behalf of the Ethel Rosenberg Centennial Project, welcome to this very historic occasion. And the man of the day is Councilman, someday Congressman, Councilman Daniel Drom, who represents the most diverse borough in the city, Queens, Jackson Heights specifically. He will present the proclamation.
Well, thank you very much, Tibby. We've also been joined by my esteemed former colleague in the City Council, now the Borough President of Manhattan, Gail Brewer. Let's give her a big round of applause. And if anybody were going to be here, I know Gail Brewer would be here for this very special occasion today. But we're here today to present this official proclamation of the City Council of New York, signed by 13 members of the City Council, to call into question the execution of Ethel Rosenberg. And I am very proud to have led this effort, and I'm going to tell you, you know, when Ethel was convicted, it was a time of Jew baiting, it was a time of McCarthyism, a time of anti-communist hysteria, and it's time now that we begin to right the wrong of what happened to Ethel Rosenberg. And that's why presenting this proclamation is so important. Over the weekend, I heard Pope Francis say that power comes quickly, but it also goes quickly, and that you should use power for the right thing to do. So if I may take those words and say, apply them to myself today, that's why I chose to do this, because I believe it's an opportunity to be able to begin to right a wrong. And when you think about it, the execution of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg left two children orphaned, left no opportunity for those people to fix the situation. The Pope himself has also spoken out against the use of death penalty, something that I have for my life been opposed to, because it does not give you an opportunity, again, to correct a wrong. And for all of these reasons, we gather here today. I want to thank Tibby for bringing this issue to my attention, but of course I knew a lot about it anyway, but thank you, Tibby. I met with the Mirapols. Also, I want to thank you, Robert, and family, and everybody else who was over here. Yep, and everybody, Charles Bayer. Where is Charles? Over here. Thank you for also using your connections to make sure that this got done today as well. And I actually do want to read this. Sometimes I say, I don't read a proclamation, but it's so very important that we read to what other council members signed on to as well. So I'm going to read it, but I do have to put the glasses on. Ethel Rosenberg, also known as Ethel Greenglass, lived in New York City's Lower East Side in the 1920s and 30s, where she excelled as a Seward Park High School student and dreamed of college. She graduated before her 16th birthday, but unable to afford college, she took a clerical training course. In 1935, at the age of 19, she worked as a clerk at the National New York Packing and Shipping Company and helped lead a strike for union recognition and a pay raise. The New York Times reported that about 150 young women pickets moved in squads. They lay on the pavement in front of the trucks and dared the drivers to move. And whereas Ethel was fired and filed a claim for wrongful termination with the National Labor Relations Board, which found in her favor, there is no allegation or evidence that she was not an efficient employee. The company's antagonism to Ethel undoubtedly arose by virtue of the fact that she was active in organizing the union. Ethel remained active in union organizing and sang to raise funds. While performing, she met Julius Rosenberg, whom she later married. And whereas during World War II, Ethel joined the East Side Defense Council as its only full-time volunteer. It was the first such organization in the nation and became a model for others. She organized blood donation drives and gave speeches on the importance of the war effort. Her first son, Michael, was born during the war, and her second son, Robert, was born after it ended. And whereas in August 1950, Ethel was charged with conspiracy to commit espionage. FBI documents reveal that Chief Prosecution Witness David and Ruth Greenglass provided no evidence against Ethel Rosenberg in their initial confessions. The Greenglass's recent release of grand jury testimony also excludes mention of Ethel's involvement. FBI documents show that members of the prosecution team determined that she should be convicted with a stiff sentence, quote unquote, and be used as a lever, quote unquote, to induce her husband to cooperate. After devising this strategy, Ruth and David Greenglass provided oral testimony against Ethel. The judge relied upon this new testimony to sentence Ethel to death. In 2001, David Greenglass admitted the testimony was false. And whereas NSA files indicate that the Soviet Union never gave Ethel a code name and that she therefore was not an active espionage agent, and that before the Rosenberg's executions, an FBI document listed questions to ask Julius Rosenberg if he cooperated. The FBI did not create such a list for Ethel and did not ask if she was involved. Instead, a question on the list was your wife cognizant of your activities? Since, despite this, the government wrongfully executed Ethel Rosenberg, now therefore be it known that we, the undersigned members of the Council of the City of New York, honor the life and memory of Ethel Rosenberg in observance of the 100th anniversary of her birth, signed by me, Councilmember Daniel Drum, Helen Rosenthal, Corey Johnson, Mark D. Levine, Richie Torres, Rosie Mendez, Carlos Menchaca, Donovan Richards, Daniel Gorodnik, Margaret Chin, Idonis Rodriguez, Vanessa Gibson, and Andrew Cohen. Thank you very, very much. Now we'll hear from our borough president.
Thank you very much.
Gail Brewer.
Thank you, Councilmember Drum, and welcome to three generations of family and everybody else who's here. I have the same wonderful proclamation, so I'm not going to read it because the council member read it so articulately. But I just want to say, when you read about Ethel Rosenberg's early life on the Lower East Side, her story sounds like many others who are inspired and passionate New York women, whose activism at a young age shaped the city's labor movement, Bessie Abramowitz Hillman, or Clara Lemlich Trevisan or Pauline Newman, all women whom we honor over and over again. The difference, of course, is that Ethel Rosenberg's life was tragically stolen from her by the U.S. government when she was only 38 and the mother of two young boys. As we know from indisputable evidence uncovered by her children and grandchildren, she was not a Soviet spy. Today we celebrate her 100th birthday, and it's time to acknowledge that what we all know, this innocent woman was unjustly executed during a shameful period of anti-communism hysteria in our country. Now we have anti-Planned Parenthood in our country. It's a terrible strain on our history, but it can be mitigated if we do today what we should have done decades ago, acknowledge the wrongful execution and bring justice to her good name and to her family. For many years, Ethel's family has been committed heart and soul to righting the wrong that is both personal and political. I cannot commend them enough for their conviction and strength in time of darkness, and I read all of the newsletters that they send me. During the past decades, especially, the United States has done the right thing and acknowledged culpability in events large and small. It cannot delay any longer doing so with the family of Ethel Rosenberg for the sake of justice. Thank you very much, and congratulations.
And now we hear some words from the people who know best, starting with Robert Miracle, former director of the Rosenberg Fund for Children.
On behalf of our family, many of whom are here today, and let me list family members who are here. My brother, Michael. Ann Mirapol, Ellen Mirapol, Ivy Mirapol, Thomas Ambrose, Greg Mirapol, Jen Mirapol, Rachel Mirapol, Tomas Hunt, and the youngest, Josie Hunt Mirapol. And I want to thank all those, even though some have been mentioned before, who have brought this to fruition, particularly Counselor Danny Drum. Yes. Thank you. And Daniel Drum initiated this effort. I also want to thank his staff member, Michael Mallon, who guided it, all the council member co-signers, and a particular thanks to Manhattan Borough President Gail Brewer for her statement, which she didn't read at the conclusion, declaring today the Ethel Rosenberg Day of Justice in Manhattan. And I also want to thank New York's public advocate, Letitia James, for her support in this effort as well. And we are grateful to Tibby Brooks and Charles Bayer of the Rosenberg family, Ethel Rosenberg Centennial Campaign, for both their hard work and good counsel, and to my daughter's partner, Tomas Hunt, for obtaining the support of additional elected officials, to Amber Black of the Rosenberg Fund for Children for her press work, and to attorney Daniel Myers, who first suggested this idea to me. And I apologize to those who I've missed. When I was born, I was brought home from the hospital to an apartment less than a mile from here, right over there. To have so many council members of my parents' hometown, my hometown, my brother's hometown, acknowledge our mother's achievements and note that she was wrongfully executed is a dream come true. Woo! Today, a major elected institution of this great city and Manhattan's borough president have taken important steps towards acknowledging a terrible injustice. Next, it is time for the federal government to step up and do the same. And one final thank you to my parents, Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, for their courage, their faithfulness to their ideals, and their activism to create a better world for their children. Now I'll turn it over to my big brother, Michael.
Today is bittersweet. Our mother would have been 100 years old today. My brother's 68, I'm 72. Had she lived to be 70, she would have seen us grow to adulthood and gotten to know her grandchildren. But the government cut her life short in her 30s. But it's also an important step on the road to her eventual exoneration. This past summer, a judge ordered the unsealing of the grand jury testimony of the chief witness against our parents. We believe that testimony provides the final piece of evidence that leads to an inescapable conclusion. Ethel Rosenberg was not an espionage agent. We believe the government framed her to put pressure on our father. They took her as a hostage and then murdered her when our father refused to falsely confess to atomic espionage and name names. So let me echo Rob's thanks to the members of the City Council, Manhattan Borough President, for recognizing the injustice that was done to our mother, and as a result, to her entire family. But we want to make it clear that the unjust prosecution and execution of our mother damaged our country as well. It culminated in the outrageous statements of the sentencing judge and President Eisenhower that our parents had caused the Korean War and a future nuclear war. It was based on perjured testimony and guilt by association arguments. These elements combined to fuel a dangerous climate of fear and intolerance in our country, which permitted political opportunists like Senator Joseph McCarthy to poison our society. We believe that the issuance of these proclamations implicitly calls upon the federal government to take corrective action. We want to make this request explicitly. We call upon Attorney General Lynch and President Obama to acknowledge the injustice done to Ethel Rosenberg as a way of learning from our past. You got it. As a way of learning from our past in the hope that similar injustices will be avoided in the future. Thank you.
We're very pleased to have with us one of the signers of the proclamation, Councilmember Mark Levine, who's chair of the Jewish Caucus.
That's right.
And when I met him, he was absolutely conversant in everything.
I don't know about that.
In every language.
I don't know about
that. In every
that.
Language.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Danny, for kicking this off. And thank you to Michael Robert for standing up. I know that if Ethel were here today, she would be so, so proud of her sons. Mm-hmm. I know that for a fact. You know, this trial, which in retrospect was so deeply flawed, took place not only in an era of McCarthyism, but in an era of rampant anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. And you better believe that the country knew that this couple was Jewish, and that many suffered from the viewpoint that to be Jewish in America was to be somehow other, to possibly have dual loyalties, perhaps even be seen as a foreigner in one's own land. And it is so clear that that created a climate where there was a demand for prosecution in a case where clearly the evidence didn't justify that. And you know, one of the reasons why so many of us oppose the death penalty in all cases is because when you screw up, there's no way to undo it. And we'll never be able to undo the injustice that was done to Ethel. What we can do, it's a small thing, but I hope it provides some solace to the family and that it advances the cause of justice, is set the record straight and exonerate this woman to whom a great wrong was done. in the name of this country, and I'm proud to add my name to those calling for such action. Thank you.
We're listening to some of the voices from a press conference on New York City Hall steps issuing a proclamation honoring Ethel Rosenberg on her 100th birthday. We'll be right back after this break. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Tuned in just now, we're listening to excerpts from a press conference honoring Ethel Rosenberg on her 100th birthday.
The dry run, the practice session to the Rosenberg case, was a trial that happened just 3 months before the Rosenberg conviction. Roy Cohn, one of the prosecutors of the Rosenberg, said that this gave them practice in the use of the two witnesses they used against the Rosenbergs. The woman that they framed up and sent to prison is Miriam Moskowitz. Still alive, age 99, she was there on the steps of City Hall that day, and we interviewed her. Miriam wrote a book about her ordeal called Phantom Spies, Phantom Justice. And Heidi, would you please read her short introduction to the book, because it'll give us an idea of who Miriam is and what they did to her.
On a sleepy summer afternoon in July 1950, in a sleepy coastal New Jersey town, the FBI, in its best imitation of 50s popular TV shows, swooped down on me and Abraham Brothman, arrested us, and threw us in jail. I was Brothman's secretary and friend. The charge against us was conspiracy to obstruct justice. I had no idea what that meant or what the government thought I had done, but I knew it portended trouble, for the charge had overtones of Soviet espionage, and in the McCarthyite political atmosphere, such hints of wrongdoing, true or not, would be disastrous. In its details, the government accused Brothman, my co-defendant, of having influenced a key witness to lie to the grand jury, which was then investigating Soviet espionage. And, it said, I had known of it. That key witness was a chemist from Philadelphia who had shaken up the world only months earlier with a startling confession that he had been America's number one spy, although he made no accusations that we had participated in his wrongdoing. His name was Harry Gold. From then on, my life seemed to be on a roller coaster going downhill. We were tried in November 1950. Gold, who had not yet been sentenced and faced a death penalty, was the prosecution's most compliant witness in detailing how Brothman and I were complicit in the charges the government leveled against us. In an atmosphere of unprecedented political hysteria and grossly misleading testimony, we were convicted and sentenced to 2 years in prison. My book, Phantom Spies, Phantom Justice, details how the events unfolded, how I spent my time in jail and then in prison, and my life afterwards. It is a personal account of mid-19th century America and the cataclysmic effect of the political perversion McCarthyism represented. As one reviewer noted, it is also a book that should be required reading for students of government and history, and for reading about the lives of people who find the inner strength to carry on against insurmountable odds.
You were arrested just before Ethel Rosenberg. Why did they arrest you?
They charged me and a co-defendant with conspiracy to obstruct justice. My co-defendant was an associate of Harry Gold who had confessed to espionage, and they were being summoned to appear before the grand jury to testify about espionage in May 47. I had nothing to do with them, but Harry Gold said, I knew they were going to lie before the grand jury that was investigating espionage, as a result of which I was arrested and indicted and convicted of conspiracy to obstruct justice. I knew they were going to lie, and I didn't run to the authorities to tell them.
A thought crime.
But it wasn't a crime because I didn't know. He lied. Now, Harry was facing the death penalty. He was being rehearsed by the prosecution. You really cannot accept that he told the truth about me when he was facing the death penalty if he had not done what the prosecution wanted him to do. When I was convicted, the same witnesses, Gold and Bentley, appeared as witnesses against Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. And of course, they were unimpeachable witnesses because I was convicted. So,
did you wind up serving time in prison?
2 years. Oh. And a $10,000 fine. I met Ethel in jail before I was sent to prison. We spent a few weeks together. She was transferred to Sing Sing Prison while I was still there. And the women and I crowded at the windows to holler her name because we saw her exiting from the building into the marshal's car that was going to speed her up to Sing Sing. And we couldn't stop it. There wasn't anything jailbirds could do. But we hollered her name in unison, Ethel, 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 and through the windows. And she got into the car smiling, so we knew she had heard us. She was a nice lady. That's a stupid thing to say.
I don't think so. I'm going to ask you a question that I asked her son, Robbie. Ethel...
No, Ethel's son.
Yes.
Not mine.
Not yours. Ethel's son, Robbie. And I said, Robbie, you know, your mother was a socialist. And we wondered, what do you think your mother, if she were here today, would be doing politically? And he talked about the great planetary crisis, the ecological crisis, and I want to ask you the same question. Politically, are you the same person you were back then, and what do you think of things?
Politically, I'm thinking, yes, I'm probably more radical. I think the difference between people who earn least and the people who, the 91% and the 2% is obscene and has to be corrected. I don't know how. I certainly do believe in socialism, but I don't think we're scheduled for it here. But something drastic has to happen. And I do believe that we need to protect the environment and climate change, because there will be nothing left when we do achieve our goals. We will have nothing, no world to live in unless we do something. The Pope was absolutely right.
Miriam, this is my co-host Heidi Boghossian, and Heidi may have something that she wants to say.
I just want to conclude by asking you, how do you feel today?
Bitter, very bitter. The public was trained to think of Ethel as a monster. And when she went to prison, she was subjected to terrible deprivation. when she was executed, it took an extra jolt of electricity to get her under. Now, you just read that up. It took an extra jolt to kill her. And I, you know, the people who convicted her and who believed, and Eisenhower and Truman leading the pack. It was unconscionable.
Miriam Moskowitz, thank you so much for speaking with us today. And in anticipation of your 100th birthday, happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Miriam.
All the key figures in the prosecution of Miriam were later involved in the prosecution of Ethel and Julius. The main witness against Ethel, Harry Gold, was the main witness against Miriam. It was the same judge, Irving Kaufman, who met privately with the prosecutors. It was the same prosecutor, Irving Sapol, and his vile assistant, Roy Cohn. So what happened to Miriam was a practice session, as they admitted, for executing the Rosenbergs.
Attorney Daniel Myers, you're a longtime friend of ours and a longtime activist and actually former president of the National Lawyers Guild here in New York City. And we understand that this marvelous event to honor Ethel Rosenberg on what have been her 100th birthday was actually your idea. And my question to you, Danny, is how'd you come up with the idea?
Well, the Rosenbergs have been part of my consciousness since I was a young child. My parents would take me to rallies and demonstrations to spare their lives. And I remember waiting for the until the Supreme Court ruled on whether or not the executions were going to go ahead. And of course they were executed, and this was a very traumatic circumstance for me, much less obviously for those who knew Julius and Ethel personally, including their children. And over the years, I've always done something to honor them. And it became easy as a member of the National Lawyers Guild. For at least 20 years, we marched on June 19, the anniversary of the executions. We marched right across the street at Foley Square in memory of the Rosenbergs and condemning the federal government, its prosecutors, and its judges for allowing this travesty to take place. And it was a strong demonstration. Lots of lawyers, including, I remember, Marshall Perlin, who later takes on the legal responsibility for the Rosenbergs. That part of our expression ended at least 10 to 15 years ago, but not the notion of the Rosenbergs. There came a time reasonably recently that I had come in contact with Robbie Meeropol. It was around after the Attica settlement. I was one of the lawyers, and after the Attica settlement, some of us made substantial contributions out of our legal fees to the Rosenberg Fund for Children, and it was named the Attica Fund. The Attica Fund was started by us, and it's for the purposes of providing transportation for family and loved ones to prisons and jails. Out of that, I kind of maintained a relationship with Robbie. And a couple of years ago, we had a conversation about doing something posthumously. So I came up with a thought that we ought to find a government agency, a government that would be likely to issue a resolution or a proclamation exonerating Ethel and putting into the appropriate context the role of Julius, which was not as an atomic spy, as he was labeled across the street by Judge Julius Kaufman, who accused him.
Irving,
sorry. Thank you. We formed a small group of people to try to figure out how we could legally and politically create something that would give some respite to the Rosenberg and the Rosenberg family, some comfort. there was talk about going to some of the West Coast cities, and I thought we should come to New York. And why come to New York? One, I thought it was a place where we could get something. But more importantly, it's where the trial took place. It's where Ethel grew up and raised her children. And I thought New York had sufficient contact. We made a very strong pitch last year, and we did not succeed. And they used the pretext of there was no jurisdiction, there was no reason that the city of New York should be involved in anything that had to do with the acts of the federal government. And that position was carried by the Speaker of the Council, who prohibited any proclamations, any resolutions, any statements allowing the Rosenbergs to be seen as victims of government repression.
Danny, how did you argue against lack of jurisdiction?
On the overwhelming contacts which I have just described, that is, the trial takes place here, the family lives here, they're citizens, if you will, of New York City, and that to me was sufficient. It wasn't. However, I came up with another argument which almost carried the day, and I was talking to five lawyers from the counsel's office, and I said, the other way of looking at why New York has jurisdiction is that it's important to do what we're saying you should do, as because it would heal lots and lots and millions of people who suffer the same way I did of this incredible travesty, who live here, who cared about the circumstances, who identified themselves as victims of that murder, of that execution. And I said it would heal the population. And I'm very happy that this is the end of the line, as far as it looks like the official city of New York. I think there's more work to do, but that's another story.
Danny, your expertise in handling complicated political cases is greatly appreciated in bringing us to this resolution today.
Oh, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for being on Law and Disorder, Danny.
Thank you.
Thank you, Danny. In a twist on the confidential informant film genre, the new film Terror chronicles a bureau investigation, but without the FBI knowing it's being watched. Filmmakers David Felix Sutcliffe and Lyric Cabral follow an ex-con named Saeed Sharif Torres, who claims to have made hundreds of thousands of dollars annually befriending Muslim targets accused of pro-terrorism inclinations. Sharif alienated a Brooklyn community of Muslim friends by helping convict jazz bassist Tariq Shah just for talking about training members of Al-Qaeda. In 2005, Sharif revealed to filmmaker Cabral that he was an FBI informant. He later agreed to let her and Sutcliffe film details of his work without the FBI's knowledge. The movie shows how Sharif was directed to befriend Khalifa al-Akili, a white Muslim convert who has publicly made pro-terrorist statements. After Sharif and the FBI tried to get Khalifa to shift from words to deeds, Sharif goes public with suspicions that the FBI has targeted him. Joining us now to talk about Terror is filmmaker David Felix Sutcliffe. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Tell us how you got the idea to make this film.
The idea for the film, on my side, first came when I was working on my first film, which was called Adama. It was broadcast on PBS in 2011, that featured the story of Adama Ba, who was one of two 16-year-old Muslim girls who was arrested in the spring of 2005 and accused of being a potential suicide bomber. And so I ended up making a film about her and her family's experiences in the aftermath of that accusation. I was pretty fresh out of college, and through the course of that project, I began to discover our government's counterterrorism tactics and noticed that, you know, the vast majority of the domestic cases being announced were kind of positioned on the use of informants, going into communities, finding men that they could encourage or convince or manipulate into participating in terrorist plots, and then having the FBI swoop in and make an arrest. And I thought, you know, this was politically an important story to tell, and I thought it's critical for more Americans to know about this tactic. But also I thought, you know, from a dramatic standpoint and psychological standpoint, I was fascinated by the idea of these informants and who these men were, and what sort of inner conflict they would live with while working on these cases, knowing that the relationships of these men would ultimately culminate with the arrest, with their arrest, and, you know, them spending decades of their life behind bars. And I happen to mention this idea to a friend of mine who is the co-director of this film, Lyric R. Cabral. And when I kind of casually announced this idea, saying, you know, I have this idea for a film about an informant, unfortunately, it's impossible, because how would you ever find an informant who would be willing to let himself be documented? She said, well, it's pretty strange that you should say that, because I actually know an informant. And it turns out that several years earlier, she had lived in a brownstone in Harlem with Saeed Torres, who he lived on the bottom floor and she lived on the top floor of a brownstone. And he's the subject of our film. He's an FBI informant who had been working for the FBI at that point for a little over, I think, 11 or 12 years. And they developed a relationship, and at one point he ultimately confessed to her that he had been working as an informant. And he wanted her initially to write a book about him, but she was also just getting out of school and felt a little overwhelmed by his confession and decided to kind of keep in touch with him, but she wasn't yet prepared to tell his story.
Did you have reservations about working with someone who claimed to be an informant? And if so, were there challenges about this process?
Yeah, I mean, the first night that we met him, I was incredibly apprehensive, you know, and nervous about just stepping into this space. You know, we were visiting him on the you know, he was about to begin a new investigation. And this was someone who, you know, through my work on that previous film, you know, I'd seen the kind of the consequences of these cases. You know, although, her, you know, Adama's case wasn't, as far as we know, the result of the use of informant, I still had met enough families who had been devastated by these cases to think of informants as, in a singular sense, as just evil entities. And through the course of making this film, I realized, you know, it's much more complicated than that, and I'm really grateful for Lyric's partnership here, because her relationship helped to inform the film and the filmmaking, and trying to create a complex portrait of this man who ultimately, you know, he was someone who was preyed upon by the FBI just as he is now being sent to prey upon others. You know, he was facing a 25-year prison sentence for robbery, and he was given the option, you know, if you provide us with some information, we can help you out. So it kind of started off small, you know, just, you know, help us out and we'll help you out. And then ultimately in the wake of 9/11, they kind of approached him and said, you have the option and the opportunity here to help us go get the bad guys, to find, you know, the people who finance this attack. And so in the beginning, that's what he thought he was doing. And I think as, you know, the years went by after 9/11, you know, that world and that terrain became increasingly murkier. And I think he felt less secure and less comfortable. But at the same time, he was making so much money that he didn't want to turn it down. And he'd also become exiled from his community once they found out that he was an informant. So he was, in a sense, you know, trapped within this position. He's a former felon. He has no other employment opportunities. And so actually working for the FBI is one of the few options he has.
With the more information that you began to glean through this process, was there any point which you and your colleague worried about your involvement in this project?
Yeah, we were very concerned from the very beginning whether we were even allowed to make this film, to tell this story. And fortunately, I had developed, you know, some relationships with the ACLU on my first film and reached out to Ben Weisner, actually, who gave us some really critical advice in the very beginning of the project, and also some, you know, some very important encouragement, you know, saying that this is an incredible opportunity to have access to an informant in the midst of an active investigation. You know, you should absolutely, you know, seize upon that opportunity, but at the same time be very careful to avoid any situations where you could be accused of tampering with the investigation. So he said, you know, do not use any information gleaned from the informant to contact the target of the investigation. He was very adamant about that, and also said, you know, this is, you have to be careful, because, you know, he knew that we were monitoring some of the conversations and present in the room when Saeed was talking on the phone to his handlers, and said, you know, under no circumstances can you or should you record their side of the conversation, the agent's side of the conversation, because it was, you know, in particular it was Pennsylvania, it's a two-party consent state. He said you could be accused of federal wiretapping. So, but, you know, by and large, you know, the rest of those he said the rest of the field is wide open. You know, let him document the story, capture what you can.
David, let's talk about some of the characters in the film. Mm-hmm. I was struck by Saeed's really defensive position, saying he wasn't entrapping people, that they were inclined to do what they were going to do, and he was just there as kind of a accessory to the fact. What was your evaluation of just how positive this guy's influence was?
The word entrapment is so loaded, unfortunately, has such a, as you well know, such a legal, narrow legal definition. You know, I think other, you know, other countries regard what we're doing as totally apprehensible and immoral. But because of this, you know, one very singular clause, if you can prove that someone is predisposed to commit a certain crime, then you can offer them any inducement that you choose. You know, in the case of the Nuremberg Four, you know, these four black men, ex-felons, are offered $250,000 to blow up two synagogues, and yet that is somehow not considered entrapment. And so, you know, that in that context, it's incredibly frustrating that, you know, the government can say, well, technically it's not entrapment. And according to this absurdly narrow legal definition, that's correct. But, you know, from any other perspective, people say, yeah, absolutely, these men are being trapped. They're being led into these situations where they have no other options, where they have no other escape. And there's so much effort and energy being put into luring like vulnerable, gullible, desperate men in, into these positions. Saeed is absolutely a part of that, you know, and at the same time, he's following orders, and they're dangling carrots in front of him and saying, you know, these cases start off saying, well, let's make an assessment. If you assess that he's a threat, then we'll continue, but if you assess that he's not a threat, then we won't continue. And this is all to kind of follow the letter of their guidelines. But in reality, you're offering an ex-felon, you know, money if he says there's a threat, and yet you're saying if you say there's no threat, then your salary, your income, your opportunity to make hundreds of thousands of dollars is gone. You know, they know exactly what they're doing, putting men like Saeed into these positions.
David is a filmmaker along with Lyric Cabral, who made the movie that's just coming out called Terror. And is that going to be showing here in New York? How can people find out about it?
Starting its theatrical run at the IFC Center in the West Village on October 7th. And we're going to be running for from October 7th to October 13th, maybe longer if we get a strong response. We might get held over. And then from there, we're going to be playing in cities around the country. You can find screening information on our website, terrordocumentary.org. We're also slated to have a national PBS broadcast in early 2016.
David, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. We hope people see the movie and draw the political conclusions from what they're doing here against Muslims. That's a general warning, I would think, one of the reasons you made the movie. We appreciate your good work, and we look forward to discussing the movie with friends of ours who we hope will go out and see it.
Well,
you take it
so
easy
much.
And good luck.
Thank you, David. Have a good day.
Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.